This podcast of Word of Mouth is supported in part by Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England. Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine, information at doucetsurvey.com. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. I was born in 1984, a full 7 years before the release of the first Star Wars movie, and yet I cannot remember a time when I did not know the names of Luke Skywalker, Han Solo, Darth Vader, and the rest. And it's not that I'm a huge fanboy or anything. Star Wars is just that ubiquitous. It's always been there. But what's most interesting about the Star Wars franchise to me is the peculiar role that fandom has played in its success. Star Wars fans are among the most vocal and passionate group of enthusiasts Hollywood has ever inspired. They're also some of the most critical. Chris Taylor is the deputy editor at Mashable, and his new book, How Star Wars Conquered the Universe, is a diligently researched history of all things Star Wars. He joins us now to explore the role fandom has played and continues to play in shaping the franchise. Chris, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Taylor.
So Star Wars, as we all know, was created by George Lucas, the creator, and he was, of course, influenced by a number of films and stories that came before. But how quickly after A New Hope was released did fans start to have their own influence on the franchise moving forward?
I think pretty much immediately. I mean, the first thing that you saw, and a lot of people who saw the movie in theaters told me this, that the first thing they saw straight away, even on day one, was T-shirts. You know, people were producing Star Wars T-shirts. They weren't licensees of Lucasfilm. They were just local T-shirt entrepreneurs. And they were producing buttons. There were buttons all over the place saying, "May the Force be with you," and "I'm hot for Han Solo," straight away from day one. And this is not something that Lucasfilm ever expected. They did get famously rather good merchandising rights in the deal for the original Star Wars. But it was really the fans that took it off and ran with it before that merchandise even hit stores.
And that level of success and that level of enthusiasm really wasn't predicted. I mean, it opened in what would be considered today a handful of theaters.
Yeah, just 32 theaters on the first day, rising to about 40 by that weekend, which was not actually that unusual in those days. It was Jaws that had sort of pioneered the widescreen release on thousands of screens at the same time. But certainly Star Wars would have liked to have opened on more of that, and theater owners would have liked it to be more widespread at the time. But they just couldn't, because they'd all booked in other movies like Smokey and the Bandit and a horrible soap opera called The Other Side of Midnight. It became a great problem for Lucasfilm and Fox to have, because it created this great supply and demand problem.
The long lines that we've come to
know. Long lines, yeah.
So we're pretty used to, these days, big franchise trilogies coming out in really short succession. I'm thinking The Lord of the Rings, The Hobbit. Mm. You know, they come out like 1 year after another. But these were very different times, and there was actually, 3 years between each film and the original trilogy?
There was. Not necessarily by design, but it just really took that long to meet the perfectionist standards of George Lucas.
So how did Star Wars fandom change from the release of A New Hope to Return of the Jedi almost a decade later?
Well, by that point, you had an awful lot of fanzines, fanzines, names like Alderaan and Skywalker, and a lot of people were writing their own stories about the franchise, sort of tacitly with Lucasfilm's approval. The 20th Century Fox lawyers weren't too happy about that. But it did certainly evolve. And by the time of Return of the Jedi, you start to get reports of people actually camping out in front of the theater for tickets, which at that point was just unheard of. And they were camping out for all of a few days beforehand. And, of course, that would, by the time of The Phantom Menace in 1999, that would become about a month.
That would be about 2.5 weeks longer than I've ever camped.
I think the record is there was a guy in Seattle who was camped out for more than 300 days before Revenge of the Sith. So there's a long record to beat for anyone who wants to camp out for Episode 7.
You mentioned people starting to write their own stories. Is that what we now refer to as the expanded universe? I guess what is the expanded universe for listeners that don't know?
So the expanded universe was the name that was given to the body of Star Wars novels, games, comic books, and just basically everything that George Lucas didn't have a hand in, but that told a story inside the Star Wars universe. And it was always sort of a second-class citizen of the Star Wars universe. It really, they had this sort of different tiers of canon, as fans call it, you know, the canon of the franchise. And, the expanded universe was always at a lower level. And, of course, recently what happened is Lucasfilm decided to say, well, actually, none of that ever happened. We're moving that over to the universe next door. That's going to be part of a new segment called Legends. And, we're not beholden to it for the new movies or any of the new material. So that was the expanded universe. And then the fan stuff almost existed outside of that, not even inside any level of canon at all. It was just done for the joy of it, really.
I'm speaking about Star Wars fandom with Chris Taylor. He's deputy editor at Mashable and author of How Star Wars Conquered the Universe. There's a really popular clip, Chris, from A New Hope that gets passed around a lot online. It's a scene that takes place in the Death Star, and there's this especially tall stormtrooper who's walking through a doorway in the background of the shot. You've almost definitely seen it. He whacks his head on the frame,
yes.
And then he keeps going as though nothing happened. Well, it's this funny little blooper. It made its way into the original film. What cracks me up the most are the comments on this YouTube video where I first saw it. One of the first ones, and it's totally in earnest, questions why, if stormtroopers were all actually clones of Boba Fett, why would one be taller than the rest? And I think there is something so emblematic of that and the Star Wars fan taking things more seriously than any of the filmmakers originally intended.
Well, not to get too geeky here, but the actual answer to that is that they were not clones of Boba Fett. The stormtroopers were actually conscripts. This is according to, the official word from Lucasfilm itself and from George Lucas. His whole idea was that the clone troopers were obviously clones, and they sort of developed their own personalities. But the stormtroopers were conscripts, and they started acting more like clones. So it's supposed to be this wonderful irony there.
Well, I suppose if I continued to read down in the comments, I probably would have found the correction.
Almost certainly. But the wonderful thing about that is that Lucas really embraced that. He's much more of a goofy director than people give him credit for. And once this was pointed out to him for the special editions that he released in 97, he didn't delete that scene with the stormtrooper hitting his head. He actually added the sound effect of the stormtrooper bashing his head on the Death Star, which I think speaks volumes about what kind of director he is.
Okay, so we can't talk about fandom without talking, of course, about the prequel trilogy. Episodes 1, 2, and 3 came out. The first one came out in 1999. Really divided Star Wars fans, and it was a split that Lucas characterized as being generational. You know, the older fans didn't like the new movies, the younger ones didn't like the old ones. Do you see it that way, or do you take a different spin on it?
It's a little more complicated than that. I mean, obviously, everyone has their own opinions about the movies. I have a chapter in the book called How I Stop Worrying and Learn to Love the Prequels that basically takes us through the stages of prequel grief and finally comes to acceptance. And I think that, you know, there is much to be commended in the prequels. It did sort of kickstart the CGI revolution, which had a lot of good things about it.
Right.
And, it filled in a lot of the areas of Jedi lore that we didn't know previously. But yeah, you know, he likes to characterize as generational. It is to a certain extent. Certainly, it's hard to find an 8-year-old or below who won't laugh at the hijinks of Jar Jar Binks.
Yeah.
And then there sort of comes a stage in your growing up where you look back on them and you embrace the original trilogy more and you just don't seem to accept the prequel trilogy as much. But all of Star Wars is really based on Flash Gordon and on that kind of space fantasy genre of the 30s and 40s, which was really incredibly cheesy.
Yeah.
And just done for the fun of it. And I really think that that's what Lucas was trying to get back to with the prequels. And maybe we were all just a little too serious about them by that point.
Having done what appears to be an unbelievable amount of research for this book, who was the biggest Star Wars fan you met throughout the time it took you to write it?
Wow. Well, the biggest in terms of the amount of stuff that he owns has to be Steve Sansweet, a former Wall Street Journal reporter who went on to work at Lucasfilm as head of fan relations And now he owns something called Rancho Obi-Wan, which is the now recognized by the Guinness Book of Records as the world's largest Star Wars collection. It has, I believe, about 300,000 items, and it's up there in a former chicken ranch up in Petaluma. You can become a member and make an appointment.
A pilgrimage.
He will give you a 3-hour tour of the place, and that's not even enough to begin to scratch the surface.
Well, fandom is a very different beast now than it was during that original trilogy. Now we've got social media, we've got YouTube, Kickstarter. How have these things and these technologies, do you think, enhanced or changed Star Wars fandom in, say, the past decade or so?
Oh, it's just exploded in so many directions. I mean, you have the Stormtrooper Legion, the 501st Legion, that of costuming enthusiasts never would have come together without the internet.
Can you explain briefly what that is?
Absolutely. This is a legion of stormtroopers, basically. They also have Darth Vaders and Boba Fetts and other bad guys, and they do a lot of work for charity. But they also, to get in the club, and about 6,500 people have done this, you have to build your own screen-accurate costume, which
Wow.
means you need 6 pouches on your belt, not 4, you know, that sort of thing. And there's a similar group called the R2 Builders Club. They spend on average about a decade building an R2-D2 to look exactly screen accurate. You know, again, brought together by the internet, even though they're tinkering in their garages. But just there are so many areas. There are so many documentaries about various aspects of Star Wars, of Star Wars history that have come together on Kickstarter. And we're seeing a cultural obsession kind of being played out and perpetuated by the internet. And, of course, we're seeing so much speculation about the next movie on the internet that you could fill entire books just with that.
Well, and actually, I'm sort of wondering if, against all odds, I don't think this is going to be the case. I personally feel like there's a good team behind it. But if the new Star Wars movies were to be just the worst bombs of all time, do you think that even that could shake the foundations of Star Wars fandom at this point? Or can Star Wars fans just endure anything?
I think it will endure. And I think the reason is, no matter how bad it is, it's going to bring in a new generation of kids. Because, you know, the prequels did, the Clone Wars TV series did. You know, what we have here is a franchise that's constantly refreshing itself with the new generations that come in, and the older generations grow up and become more cynical about it, and perhaps for a moment they're able to drop their cynicism and accept the joy of just this fun, quirky, weird franchise for what it is. But I also think that J.J. Abrams has assembled a marvelous team, as you say, and everything we're hearing out of it, all of the rumors, if true, do suggest that we're in for a rollicking good story.
So should I expect to see you camping out in line?
Probably not. I think that's more of a 20-something male activity, but I'm sure it will happen. And, God bless and Godspeed to all of those guys camping out.
Chris Taylor, deputy editor at Mashable and author of the new book, How Star Wars Conquered the Universe. Chris, may the Force be with you.
And also with you, Taylor.
The first Star Wars movie spawned countless fan clubs, a merchandising empire, comic books, and a 6-hour radio play. In 1981, NPR produced and aired a 13-part series called Star Wars: A New Hope, inspired by the original film. With a John Williams score, Mark Hamill playing Luke Skywalker, and Anthony Daniels reprising his role as C-3PO, the radio drama had all the elements people loved about George Lucas's saga, but there was also lots of new characters and scenes that never saw the big screen.
She sounds smooth, Luke.
Yeah, I worked on her all day yesterday.
Well, listen, if you're planning on doing any racing, you can count me out, Skywalker. Tatooine is no academy, and you're no star pilot.
Not yet, anyway. Well, I adjusted the thrust sequence for extra boost. You better hang on to your seat.
That's from Star Wars: A New Hope, the radio drama produced by NPR in 1981. They went on to produce and air 2 more radio dramas, one for The Empire Strikes Back and another for Return of the Jedi. If you'd like to learn more about NPR's Star Wars-inspired radio dramas, you'll find a link on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And the Force stays with us a bit longer. Up next, we'll hear from a member of one of the most exclusive Star Wars fan clubs out there, the 501st. We'll talk to a web designer by day, Darth Vader by night, when Word of Mouth returns. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. There are many levels of Star Wars fandom, as author and Star Wars historian Chris Taylor explained before the break. Near the top of that hierarchy is the 501st, a Star Wars costuming fan club that has over 6,000 members across all 50 states and 25 countries. One member of New England's garrison is Bob Govair, graphic designer by day, Darth Vader by night. Bob, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So what costumes have you made for the 501st?
Too many. I've made a Darth Vader costume. I've made Boba Fett costume, and Stormtrooper, Biker Scout.
Biker Scout from Return of the Jedi?
Exactly.
And I've heard you made a full-size Jabba the Hutt.
Yes, I was one of several people on a team of nerds constructing a life-size Jabba the Hutt.
And would you consider the Vader costume as that kind of the crowning achievement of your, I guess, collection?
It's a toss-up between the Darth Vader and the Boba Fett. They're both high on my scale.
And about how long does it take to make one of these costumes?
It took me roughly 2 years to put together my first Darth Vader and about a year to put Boba Fett together.
Wow.
And even still, after they're completed, there's constant upgrades, and they're never truly completed.
Now, is this like Civil War reenactors where, you know, in order to be considered a legitimate reenactor and take part in certain events, you know, that they have to be very rigorously created to be an accurate representation of something? You know, are there requirements?
Yeah, actually, we have things called a CRL. It's a costume requirements list where people have gone and researched all the important parts of each costume, you know, based on the original movie costumes, and then we judge them against those lists. So if you meet all the requirements of that list, then your costume's approved.
So you couldn't have, for example, like a pink Darth Vader. That would be against the rules.
Exactly. It has to be movie accurate.
So when you appear as Darth Vader, what sort of events do you and your fellow members of the 501st attend? Where are you going?
We've done all kinds of events. They range from local parades, to big events like the 2007 Rose Parade we were in, all the way down to store events for specific licensed products or hospital visits. We'll do charity walks, blood drives.
And do you stay in character, look menacing, or do you, you know, shake hands, kiss babies, that sort of thing?
A little bit of both. Depends on the environment and the people we're around. If the small children, they're afraid, then we'll ham it up a bit. But if it's an older crowd, then we do definitely love to give them the movie-accurate portrayal of the character.
So at what point did, I guess, you cross over from a casual Star Wars fan to say, you know what, I'm going to spend 2 years building a Darth Vader costume. That's what I'm going to do.
In a moment of boredom, I was surfing the web and found the website, 501st.com, and sparked my imagination. I didn't even realize this existed before. And so I started looking at things online and seeing other people had done it and realized it was a possibility. So that was roughly around 2002, and I've been doing it ever since.
And let me just say that the costumes that you and pretty much all the costumes in the 501st are really beautifully rendered. These are costumes that really require some serious artistry.
Definitely. It's not for the faint of heart. It takes a lot of skill, definitely a lot of effort in building these things. It's not a one-stop shop where you can go to Vader's R Us and pick up these kits. There's a lot of painting involved. There's a lot of sewing involved. For example, with Vader, there's a lot of leather work. So if you're not able to do that yourself, you need to find the right channels to find someone who can do it for you. There's electronic work involved as well on a lot of these kits. Something that I wasn't even familiar with going in, and through other people helping me, I've learned a lot of stuff constructing these.
So the 501st primarily, stormtroopers. There's Darth Vader's in each separate chapter. You know, the bounty hunters like Boba Fett. What about the good guys? Is there anybody making Yoda or Leia costumes? Is there a good guy version of the 501st?
Yes, and that would be our sister group, the Rebel Legion. And there are local chapters, you know, there are chapters all around the world, and just like the 501st, and they portray all the good guys.
And yet somehow they're less cool.
I would say, yeah. Everyone wants to be the bad guy.
So last question,
most
memorable experience that you've had in the 501st, is there a time that you really thought, you know, this is why I do this?
It was definitely my pinnacle moment, I would think, would be the 2007 Rose Parade. George Lucas decided he was the master of ceremonies for the parade that year, and he decided that he wanted to march along with stormtroopers from all over the world. So Lucasfilm put out the call and basically collected 200 stormtroopers from all around the world, and we marched the entire parade.
Well, Bob, or Lord Bob Vader, I should say, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
Bob Govair is a graphic designer by day and Lord Vader by night. He's a member of the 501st Legion's New England Garrison, and you can see some photos of Bob's costumes and a video from the Rose Parade. And check out Chris Taylor's book, How Star Wars Conquered the Universe. All of that's at wordofmouthradio.org. And the fun continues on Word of Mouth when we return the case for embracing games as a family. First, the news.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. If you're a parent, you've likely heard the most dreaded sentence spoken by your child: I'm bored. You can provide countless suggestions to cure the dreaded disease of childhood boredom, but chances are the only way to truly get rid of it is to join forces with your kids. Elizabeth Foy Larson is a writer and editor whose stories on children and families have appeared in the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, Mother Jones, and Parents. She co-wrote the new book, Unbored Games: Serious Fun for Everyone, with Joshua Glenn. Elizabeth, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Your earlier book, Unbored, was about all kinds of ways to fight boredom. This book focuses solely on games. So why do you think games deserved a whole separate book?
Well, for several reasons. First of all, we were thinking about different ways that kids can have fun with each other or with their families. And as kids get older, one of the things they still like to do, or at least my kids still like to do with their parents, is play games. But also because they emphasize a lot of skills that we think are important to today's kids, including problem solving, another one which is trying things over and over and over again until you get it right. So to master a game, you have to practice a lot. We also love games because games are a natural way for kids to customize things that they don't necessarily like. So we encourage the kids that read our book to take different kind of games, whether it's Monopoly or a more complicated video game, and use it in a way that makes sense to them.
Kind of hack it, I guess, is the new terminology.
You would say hack it. Yes, that is the terminology.
Okay, well, there's so many examples in the book across so many different types of games, so let's just get into some. Many of them don't require special equipment or a traditional game board. Some, one of my favorites, just requires pen and paper, like Exquisite Corpse. Now, how does this game work?
So it's a game that where you fold up a piece of paper, sort of like a fan with accordion folds. So the first person draws the head of whatever this creature or person is that you're going to be. And it could be an animal head, it could be a human head, it could be a fantasy creation. And then you turn it over, then the next person in the game maybe makes the body or the upper part of the torso, and so on and so on. You can play it either with two people or you can play it with a bigger group.
And I guess the whole idea is that so one person starts, the next person can only just see a little bit of what that first person did. I guess
you might see the shoulder marks just so you know
right.
Basically where you are supposed to draw, but you wouldn't see anything else.
And it's like this creative collaboration. Nobody exactly knows what the finished product is going to look like until it's done and then you've got it there.
Yes. That's part of what we also like about games, is that some are complex and you have to buy a whole board and a kit, but a lot of the games in our book also just require something as simple as a deck of cards or dice.
Well, one game that requires absolutely no materials, and I'm a big fan, everybody in the office knows that this is how I like to make all the important decisions around Word of Mouth, is through rock, paper, scissors.
Rock, paper, scissors.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this book provides what I thought were a really fun couple of alternative ways to play For example?
You can do what we call rock, paper, scissors, lizard, Spock. And this is something that was popularized on The Big Bang Theory, which I know my kids love. The scissors are just the normal V. The Spock is the two finger on each side V. And then the lizard is where your fingers and your thumb are together almost like a circle. And it's got its own hierarchy in the same way that rock, paper, scissors has.
We mentioned hacking an existing activity to make it sort of more game-like does seem to be a theme throughout the book. Alka-Seltzer battle makes a squirt gun fight into something a little crazier. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that game, and specifically, I guess, how do you win?
Well, you know, some of our games, first of all, it's pretty hard to tell who wins, and that's another thing that we like to emphasize, is that part of the fun about games is simply the act of playing them. But the Alka-Seltzer battle is one that actually does have a winner. So you take an Alka-Seltzer tablet and you drill a little hole in it, then you put a piece of yarn through it and you wear it like a charm on a necklace. And then with either a squirt gun or probably better yet, a super soaker.
Oh, yeah.
And the point of the game, which again should be played probably in a bathing suit, is to squirt water at the Alka-Seltzer tablet until it completely dissolves. And so the first person for it to dissolve is out, and the last person who still has the tablet around their neck wins.
There are indoor games, outdoor games, but you also dedicate a few of the pages to online games and apps. So I'm wondering, why did you think it was important to include the computer-based stuff that parents might think we're actually trying to get away from?
For several reasons. First of all, this is the world today that kids live in. And I think we think that there are a lot of creative uses for digital games, that we didn't want to do a book that was just sort of a nostalgic throwback to the kind of games we played as kids, although there are plenty of them in there because we love them and think they're great. There are lots of creative ways to use Minecraft. Teachers are using Minecraft to teach anything from design and like city planning to other kind of strategy-based decisions. So we wanted to do a book that celebrated that these kind of games are great as well, with the caveat being that the only thing as a parent that you have to watch out for with these games is whether or not your child can easily transition off of them.
So if you were going to say, and I know this has got to be tough, there's so many games, but what's your hands-down absolute favorite from the book, the one that you play the most, the one that you are most excited about to include in the book?
My favorite game that I play with my kids is a game called Anomia, and it is a word association card game that you play in a group. And we interviewed its creator, and his name is Andrew Innes, in the book. So we really wanted to have kids learn that games aren't just these things that are just sort of imposed on you. They're a process and something you can create. So it was important for us to have someone in the book who had actually done it and had gone through all of the different processes of putting a game together and trying it and having it fail and figuring out what the right way was to do it. So I love Anomia, and it's particularly great because just two decks of cards. We take it, my family takes it on trips, we play it at home, so that's my favorite.
Well, Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Elizabeth Foy Larson is a writer and editor whose stories on children and families have appeared in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, Mother Jones, and Parents. She co-wrote the new book, Unboard Games, Serious Fun for Everyone, with Joshua Glenn, which is a follow-up to their best-selling book, Unboard, The Essential Field Guide to Serious Fun. You can find a link to both books at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And we move from family games to one of the most watched sports in America, basketball. Last year, 26.3 million people tuned in to watch the NBA Finals, but basketball wasn't always as fast-paced and exciting as it is today. Roman Mars of 99% Invisible and producer Eric Mennel brings us this story about two seemingly minor tweaks that forever impacted the world of basketball.
This is 99% Invisible. I'm Roman Mars. There are two developments in the game design of basketball that make it so that you can stand to watch it on TV. The first is they cut a hole in the bottom of the basket. For the first 10 years of basketball, It was a closed basket, and the gameplay had to stop, and the official would climb up and take the ball out of the basket every time a goal was scored. While you ponder that absurdity, I'll tell you the second, more subtle development that sped up the game and made basketball the sports juggernaut that it is today. The shot clock.
For the uninitiated, a shot clock is the smaller clock that you sometimes see counting down in the bottom corner of the TV screen.
Our reporter, Eric Mennel.
In the NBA, when a team gets the ball, they have 24 seconds to make a shot, or it's a violation, and they lose the ball.
But this hasn't always been the case. In the early 1950s, during pro basketball's infancy, there was no shot clock. Nothing forced a player to actually shoot the ball.
And if a team was winning and they wanted to keep their lead, they could literally hold onto the ball for 10 minutes.
I mean, the game stunk. It was boring. It was stupid.
This is Dolph Schayes. He's in the NBA Hall of Fame, a former player and coach whose career spanned two eras of basketball, before the inception of the shot clock and after. He says this problem of players running time off the clock by just dribbling the ball around can really be summed up in a 1950 game between the Fort Wayne Pistons and the Minneapolis Lakers.
It was a big game near the end of a season, and so the Pistons,
who were ahead,
decided to have a slowdown,
meaning run time off the clock.
Well, the game ended up 17-16.
As the final score?
Or something like that. It was in the teens.
Actually, it was 19-18. Go Pistons!
And of course, the crowd was booing. I mean, it became a real farce.
It was such a joke that in 1953, NBC decided to forego coverage of the NBA championship. They thought the game would be too boring.
Finally, it became a crisis. So basketball needed a rule change.
1954, enter Danny Bizone, owner of the Syracuse Nationals, the team Dolph Schayes played for. Bizone had crunched some numbers, and he believed that some simple arithmetic could save basketball.
And Danny Bizone said, look, I have this formula. Why don't we try it out?
Bizone figured that the best games of basketball, the ideal games, had teams scoring 80 or more points each.
A score that Bizone figured was high enough to retain the audience's interest.
Right, so Bizone started tracking how many shots a team needed to make to score a requisite 80-something points.
Each team averaged 60 shots per game.
And there's two teams, that means 120 shots.
And the game was still 48 minutes long, and 48 minutes equates to 2,880 seconds.
So you divide the number of seconds in a game.
2,880.
By the number of shots.
120.
And you get
24.
24 seconds per shot.
And to hold a player to that standard, you need a 24-second shot clock. Bizone invited a bunch of league officials to Syracuse to watch a practice game using the shot clock. Our man Dolph Schayes played in that game.
Everybody felt the 24 seconds, I mean, it was a very short period of time. So when we got the ball, I said, shoot it, shoot it, shoot it. And everybody felt, oh my God, you got to shoot it.
The entire team's sense of time had become compressed.
And the owners loved it.
Even in these practice games, there was a new sense of suspense. The owners felt it, and the players learned to love it too. The clock became official in the 1954-55 season.
Other changes in the pro game is limiting the offensive team to 24 seconds of possession with the basketball.
Immediately, the scoring went up.
Teams scored almost 30 points more a game those next few seasons. And shortly after that, attendance jumped by 40%.
That 24-second clock, that little idea, revolutionized and saved the game of basketball.
99% Invisible was produced this week by Eric Mennel, Sam Greenspan, and me, Roman Mars. We're a project of KALW and the American Institute of Architects, San Francisco. Distributed by PRX at PRX.org. More about this story at 99%invisible.org.
Big data, web analytics, internet tracking technology. Online advertisers go to great lengths to find out who we are and what we like these days. But how much do they really know about us? The answer to that question when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott today. It's a phenomenon most people have gotten used to by now. You're looking for a new pair of boots online. Next thing you know, shoe ads are popping up on every web page you visit. Welcome to the world of intelligent marketing and consumer differentiation, where companies target their advertisements based on your unique trail of digital data. But how much can you really tell about a person based off their search history or the targeted ads that pop up when they're surfing the web? Well, let's find out. Jer Thorpe is an adjunct professor at NYU and co-founder of the Office for Creative Research, where he and a team of colleagues have been working on a web browser extension called Floodwatch, which basically collects, monitors, and analyzes your online advertising history. Jer, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So you engineered a little experiment to see how much someone could tell about you based on the personalized ads from your web browser. Tell us a little bit more about the experiment. What exactly did you do?
Well, what I did is I took about 2 weeks of advertisements that had been shown to me in the browser that I'd collected with Floodwatch. So this is about 2,000 ads, and I took a big image where I tiled them all together, and I sent them to 10 strangers, and I asked them to write a character profile of me. How do they imagine me just from these advertisements? Yeah, I mean the results are pretty funny. I think if you listen to my ad history, I'm an unemployed mid-20s male who plays video games a lot.
And are you? Is that what you are?
I am one of those things. The only thing they got right was my gender.
Oh.
So there were some pieces in these puzzles that people guessed correctly. One out of the 10 people guessed that I was Canadian, for example. Almost all of them said that I work with technology, which is true. So it's not that they were just completely absurd, but they didn't provide a very good picture.
Well, what were the ads? I mean, you know, if you could maybe, I know this sounds kind of strange, but walk me through the process of someone who might be trying to figure out something about you. You know, what were these ads that they were looking at,
yeah,
and what were they divining that information from?
Yeah, it's funny to kind of look through them now, because it was just 2 weeks of my life, and so some of the things that were happening in those 2 weeks that were kind of taken as things that define me as a person were just characteristic of that 2 weeks. Like, I think I, like, looked for underwear at some point, you know, I just, like, wanted to buy some new underwear at Uniqlo or something like that. So then, of course, there's, like, 30 ads about for underwear, which people interpreted in all kinds of different ways. you know, I'm looking at it right now, though. I mean, there's a couple of camera shops because, you know, again, I was looking for a new lens for my camera. There are a bunch of ads from Vimeo to subscribe to their pro service. There's a fair number of employment ads, which I have no idea where those came from. So it's kind of a mixed bag. But even me, knowing me, looking at this profile, I don't see a ton of myself in there. I mean, you called it intelligent advertising. One of the things that I think we've seen with this project is I don't think it's quite as intelligent as we think it is.
What were you trying to prove through this experiment? Just that?
Well, what we're trying to do is to try to reverse engineer these algorithms that advertisers are using to place ads in front of people so that we can understand what kind of decisions are being made, first of all, and what kind of data they may be using. Between the moment where you enter in the URL of a page and the time in which those ads appear on your screen, there's about 3 seconds usually. There's this whole auction that happens around you, around Taylor, around you as an individual to decide which ads appear on that screen. And that auction is totally informed by all these little tiny bits of data that are being collected about you. Some of that is about your browser history, but more and more and more, it's real-world stuff. It's which stores have you visited? When was the last time you bought a car? How many countries have you been in? Have you been in an airport? Have you checked into a hotel? There's a lot of information which is now being kind of baked together to try to make these targeted advertisements better. But we know very, 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 very little about that process because it's proprietary and nobody wants to talk about it.
It seems to me there's this sort of interesting divide in the rhetoric that we hear about targeted advertising. You know, on the one hand, privacy advocates worry a lot about advertisers knowing virtually everything about a person based off their search histories and other online data, and that this data collected en masse can sort of paint a very detailed portrait of a person. But I think practically speaking, the impression that many of us get when actually using the internet, and I think your story speaks to this, is that, you know, these companies have no idea who we are, is that they're throwing ads at us hoping that they're relevant when so often they are only relevant to this 1 week where we were searching for this one thing.
Yeah, I think in some ways the advertising industry has got a little bit carried away with the kind of fun spy pursuit of people's hidden identities and how much they can put together from these little fragments of data that are being left behind, when really, you know, if they just asked us, they could probably get this information a lot faster. You know, there's all these guesses being made about what I'm interested in. You know, probably if you offered me a 10% discount on a new camera lens, if I told you my three top hobbies, I would just tell you.
So the tool that you offered these random individuals to help analyze your web browser ads, this is the thing called Floodwatch, which you helped develop. Tell us a little bit more about what that does. I mean, how does it format information? How does it present information so that we can, I guess, get something from it?
Yeah, I think conceptually it's sort of easy to think about it as being kind of a history page for advertisements, so that, you know, just like when you open up your browser history page and you can see which web pages you've been to, this lets me see which advertisements I've been shown. Now, it's a lot prettier than your history page. We do a lot of kind of, I think, really fun visualization techniques that allow you to sort your ads by color or sort them by the websites you've seen them on or sort them by the category. So you can say, show me all the tech ads or show me all of the movie ads that I've seen. We also give you a timeline so that you can maybe explore what times are you seeing the most ads or how does a single ad reappear to you over weeks and months. And so for the individual, it's kind of a way just to get a glimpse into this exposure that we only usually get in bits and pieces. And then we're partnering with researchers who are going to take the aggregated data set and really be focusing on malpractice and differential practice and maybe even discriminatory practice.
Well, yeah, I read that, you know, the hope is that Floodwatch might be able to identify some of these sort of ethical dilemmas posed by targeted advertising. What do you think some of those ethical issues might be?
Well, I think it comes down to this idea that people from maybe underprivileged communities will be being seeing different ads than the same people who aren't in those underprivileged communities. So, you know, it may be about financial services. It could be that, like, certain types of financial services are being served to people who don't have a lot of money as compared to the financial services that are being served to others. You know, that's not a new practice. We know that, you know, if I want to attract wealthy people, I'm going to put an ad in a yacht magazine. That's not particularly new. What's new is how individualized it gets, that this is not happening now in kind of an optional way, like I may or may not pick up this yacht magazine, but instead it's kind of a blanket policy that's being applied to you as an individual.
Do you worry at all that companies and brands who, you know, are very interested in gathering data and looking at it in different ways might see a browser extension like Floodwatch and think, hey, what a great idea, and then modify it for the opposite purpose for which it was designed?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that's going to happen. There's two problems with that. And the first is that they need to get enough users for it to be worthwhile. And you know, our way that we're attracting users is to say, hey, come and help this big community engagement, this kind of collective common good thing. And so for an advertiser to do this, they'd probably have to pay people, which I'm not saying is impossible, but probably at the scale that we're trying to do it would be fairly difficult. But actually, I'll say that the response we've been getting from advertisers has been really, really surprisingly positive. You know, a lot of people have been saying, hey, this is good. This is a wake-up call for us as an industry. We have to be better at this. We have to be more responsible. We have to understand that at some point we're going to be breaching trust with consumers. So we should look at this as a good thing. It's a way for them to get some understanding of the system as a whole. You know, there's no watchmaker behind the advertising system. It's a jumble of thousands of different interests. And I think, you know, the good guys in advertising, I think they're looking at this very positively.
Well, Jer, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Yeah, no problem.
Jer Thorpe is an adjunct professor at NYU and co-founder of the Office for Creative Research. You can find out more about Jer Thorpe without having to look at his search history and learn more about the ad tracking web extension called Floodwatch. That's all at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for joining us today. If you like what you heard, there's more at wordofmouthradio.org. Earlier in the show, we spoke to Bob Govert. He's a member of one of the most exclusive Star Wars fan clubs, the 501st, about what it takes to embody the characters.
There's a lot of painting involved. There's a lot of sewing involved with Vader.
There's a lot of, you know, leather work, so if you're not able to do that yourself, you need to find someone who can do it for you.
We've compiled photos of Bob's costumes, including one of him as Darth Vader, hanging out at home plate at Fenway Park. You can see those, and we promise you want to, on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott. Join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.